So let's get started. Today we're going to quantize the field, the free Klein-Gordon field, using the technique of canonical quantization. And so this is very analogous to the procedure you're used to in standard non-relativistic quantum mechanics. So in non-relativistic quantum mechanics, what you do is you take the generalized positions and their conjugate momenta, and you impose that they obey, promote them to operators, and impose that they obey the standard commutation relations. And also all of the positions commute among themselves, as do the momentum. And just as a reminder, we're always using natural units, so there's no, never going to explicitly write the factors of H bar. So yesterday we found the conjugate momentum to the Klein-Gordon field. And we found that we expressed the field in terms of these functions A of k and A star of k. And we found that the momentum was equal to phi dot. And so we can compute that just by taking a time derivative of this equation we found. And that is enough to allow us to impose commutation relations and quantize the field. So in the Schrodinger picture, we want to do precisely the same thing we did in non-relativistic quantum mechanics. We just want to impose that the field, so if we're in the Schrodinger picture, the field is only a function of space. So basically, we just need to set t equal to 0 here to eliminate the time dependence. The field is now becomes an operator, and we impose that it obeys the following commutation relation with its conjugate momentum, which is now also an operator. So all that happens is this Kronecker delta becomes a Dirac delta. And likewise, the field should commute with itself, and the momentum should commute with itself. So we have phi of x, phi of y equals 0, and pi of x, pi of y, the commutator between those is also 0. And so this is enough. We've basically, this is the quantization step. We now quantize the field. It will also often be useful to, so once we've done that, we can still use this expression, but now the A's become operators as well. So after we've promoted phi to an operator, we want to leave the measure just as a as an integral measure. We don't want to change these e to the I kx's. So if the right-hand side is an operator 2, A and A star become operators. And so A of k becomes the operator A sub k, and A star of k becomes the operator A dagger k. So functions become operators. And in tutorial, you'll work out what these commutation relations imply for the commutation relations of AK and AK dagger. So it's just the basic procedure you'll do is just take these relations and plug in this equation that relates the field operators to these momentum space creation and annihilation operators. And so the results, which we'll use in today's lecture, to work out in tutorial, are that this commutation, a relation between the annihilation and creation operator, is just two pi cubed times two e k of k minus p, and the annihilation operators commute among themselves, as do the creation operators. Furthermore, we computed the classical Hamiltonian in lecture yesterday. And if you just plug in these results, you can find the Hamiltonian operator. And again, you'll do this in tutorial. Results from the tutorial. And so again, the procedure to do this is really just a few lines of algebra starting from the results we have up there. So what we see from looking at this expression for the Hamiltonian is that we basically have infinitely many decoupled harmonic oscillators. So if this Hamiltonian was just 1/2 E times this product of creation and annihilation operators, that's just a single harmonic oscillator. We now have infinitely many, one for each value of K, and there are no cross terms in our Hamiltonian that tell the that cause interactions between the harmonic oscillators that correspond to different values of the momenta. So this is a useful picture to keep in mind. So the free Klein-Gordon field corresponds to infinitely many harmonic oscillators. And we could have seen that, could have expected that just from looking at the classical Klein-Gordon equation. So the classical Klein-Gordon equation, if we look at it in momentum space, just looks like for each value of the momentum, just looks like a harmonic oscillator equation. Okay. So these are the some of the most important operators in the theory. Next, let's look at the states. So the simplest state of all is the vacuum state. Which in the free theory, I'll denote as zero. And so the vacuum state is just a state that is annihilated by all of the annihilation operators. And it's also useful to choose the vacuum to be unit normalized. Okay. So one of the simplest questions we can ask about the vacuum state is, what is this energy? And to figure that out, we can just act with the Hamiltonian on the vacuum state. And that will just give us the energy E naught of the vacuum. And using this expression that you'll derive in tutorial, this just gives us 1 half integral d3k over 2 pi cubed 2ek. Ek ak ak dagger. Zero, since if we act with this term on the vacuum state, we just get zero. Because all of the annihilation operators annihilate the vacuum. So only one term survives. And we can evaluate this by using the commutation relations here between AK and AK dagger. And so let's do that. So we have now that H acting on the vacuum gives us, if we use the commutation relations, what we get is 1 half integral d3k ek delta of 0. This expression doesn't seem to make a whole lot of sense. So we've got delta of 0, which is not defined, and an integral that looks horribly divergent. So we found that the energy of the vacuum diverges. That is something new. We didn't find that in non-relativistic quantum mechanics. And let's think a bit about more about where this infinity comes from to see how much of a problem it is. So there's really two different infinities here. So one coming from the fact that we've got a delta of 0. And the other, that's this divergent integral over the zero-point energy of each of the oscillators. So let's look at those one at a time. And they really come from different places, different there's different reasons for them. So the divergence associated with this delta of 0 is what's known as an IR divergence, IR for infrared, which means it comes from large distance scales or low energy. And to see where, so this is the one associated with the delta of 0. And to see where this comes from, let's try to rewrite delta of 0 in a different form. and I'll put a 2 pi cubed in front of it. So we know that if we do an integral of e to the I p dot x, or x sub p, we'll get a delta function. We'll get a delta of 2 pi cubed delta of p. So this looks like this kind of integral evaluated at p equals 0. We can get, so this expression evaluated at p equals 0 just looks like a volume. And we can get rid of this infinity by putting the universe in a box. So assuming that instead of having infinite Minkowski space, our universe obeys some, let's say, periodic boundary conditions. Say, put it in a box of size L over 2. And we haven't done anything if we then take the limit L goes to infinity. So here we're putting the universe in a box of size L. So for finite L, this integral then just gives us, we said p equals to 0, this term is not here. This term is not here, so this is just the volume of the box. So it's the limit L goes to infinity of minus L over 2, L over 2 of E3x, which is just the volume. So we can think of this divergence as just coming from the infinite volume of the universe, which is not terribly surprising, because the question we were asking is, what is the total energy of the ground state? So we can think of the total energy of the ground state as the energy density of the ground state times the total volume. And if the total volume diverges unless the energy density is 0, then we expect the total energy to diverge. So it's not in no way surprising that we got infinity. So let's compute the energy density. And so this is just E naught over V. And if we identify 2 pi cubed delta as V, then from our expression for E naught here, this is E naught, we can read off the energy density of the ground state. And so that just gives us D3K over 2 pi cubed times the energy of each of the infinitely many harmonic the zero point energy of each of the infinitely many harmonic oscillators we have. And this, again, diverges. And so that's really just because we have infinitely many decoupled harmonic oscillators. And this is what's known as a UV divergence, or ultraviolet. So a high energy or short distance scale divergence. And so one way to think about where this comes from is we are demanding that our theory is valid to arbitrarily high energies, which is not necessarily a reasonable assumption. So for one, we're neglecting gravity. So presumably, quantum gravity effects become important if we go to small enough distance scales. So if we're dealing with a theory that has no gravity, it's completely unreasonable to expect it to work to arbitrarily high energies. So at best, we expect this to work up to some high energy cutoff, lambda. So we can think of this really all of the quantum field theories we write down will break down at some high energy scale. However, there's other ways we could think about where this infinity comes from. So one of them is that when we went from the classical theory to the quantum theory, there was an ambiguity. In the classical theory, the commutator of phi and pi is zero. So we can add a multiple of that commutator to our classical theory, and we haven't changed it at all. That does change the quantum theory by just some multiple of the commutator of phi and pi. And by choosing some appropriate constant, we could cancel this off. So another way to think about where this divergence comes from is it's an ambiguity in going from the classical theory to the quantum theory. Furthermore, since we're dealing with non-gravitational physics, there's no way we can directly measure this. So oftentimes in quantum field theory, when we run across divergent quantities, it's because we're not terribly concerned about that fact as long as the quantity that diverges is not observable. And we'll see this all the time in quantum field theory. Not so much in this course, because we'll mostly be dealing with tree-level effects, but in QFD2, certainly, and later in the year. Another perspective of where this infinity comes from is we're asking the wrong question. We're asking about something that we can't, in principle, observe. And if we can't observe it, there's no reason to expect it to be finite. So those are just a few different perspectives on this divergence. And our perspective for now is we're just going to ignore this and normal order all of our operators. So normal ordering means putting all of the annihilation operators on the right. And so, for instance, we're basically only going to be concerned with the normal ordered Hamiltonian, which is just the Hamiltonian we computed with all of the annihilation operators moved to the right by hand without using the commutation relations. And so after we move the annihilation operators to the right, we just get two copies of the same term. So we have 2 over 2 integral d3k over 2 pi cubed 2ek ek ak dagger ek. So for non-gravitational physics, this vacuum energy is mostly not going to be important. There's one important exception, the Casimir effect, that we'll explore in some more detail in tutorial this afternoon. OK. So that is the simplest state. And we already ran into some new interesting effects. Let's look at the other states, the states with particles. Okay. So the way we can construct the other states is by acting with our creation operators on the vacuum. And so our one particle states which I'll denote as K, are just the states we get by acting with AK on the vacuum state. And show in tutorial that these have momentum K and energy EK. So to show that it has energy EK, it's a very similar calculation to what we just did. And to show it has momentum K, we'll have to first construct the momentum operator, which we'll go through the details of that in tutorial. We won't otherwise need the momentum operator today. So one important comment about these states is that they are not unit normalized. So we compute the inner product of P with K, which we get just by using the commutation relations is, I can write this as 0 AP A dagger K, 0. And after we use the commutation relations, that just gives us 2 pi cubed, 2 EK delta P minus K. So they're not unit normalized. We have this extra factor of 2 EK here. And this is very convenient because then these states, the normalization of these states is Lorentz invariant. The right-hand side of this equation is Lorentz invariant. Yeah. And by the same procedure, we can construct the n particle states just by acting with the creation operators n times on the vacuum. And since our creation operators commute, that implies that these particles are bosons. Okay. And in fact, this was not a choice. You may think that if we started with the Klein-Gordon field and tried to impose anti-commutation relations, we'd get fermions, but that would be inconsistent.
Yes. Mary Jane? How did you get the line above the last one?
This line?
Yeah.
So to get this line, I used the commutation relation between the annihilation operator and the creation operator. So that gives me two terms. It gives me this term plus the operators in the other order. And since AP, the annihilation operators annihilate the vacuum, the other term is just 0. So the other term, this would be plus 0 AK dagger, AP, zero. And this is zero, so the annihilation operator annihilates the kept vacuum, and the creation operator annihilates the raw vacuum on the left. So this is zero. Yes?
These things have, like, completely well-defined momentum, so they don't have any completely well-defined, it's like, position, right?
That's correct.
The only way, is it like, would you build realistic states by, like, integrating over a few of these, or?
So if we act with the field phi of x on the vacuum, we'll get a completely localized in position particle. And we can construct wave packets that have sort of localized momentum and sort of localized position, which we'll do that tomorrow, actually. So yeah, it's possible to construct any state that obeys the uncertainty principle. Any other questions? All right. So we can define a number operator, n, which counts the number of particles we have. If we act with this operator on a one particle state, we'll just get back the original state. We basically have to, if we use the commutation relations a few times, we'll cancel off this denominator and this integral using the 2 pi cubed 2e delta we get using the commutation relations, and so we'll just get back the original state. And likewise, if we act with this on an n particle state, we'll just get back n. So this operator counts the number of particles in a state. And shouldn't be surprising that since this looks almost exactly like our normal order Hamiltonian, without a factor of E, that it in fact commutes with the normal ordered Hamiltonian. And that means that in this theory, particle number is conserved. So we failed at our first goal of from yesterday of trying to be able to describe particle creation and annihilation. It's not property of quantum field theory in general. It's just a property of the specific, very simple quantum field theory we're studying so far, the Klein-Gordon theory, which has no interactions. It's called the free theory. And so as soon as we add interactions, we'll find that this no longer holds. So this is basically telling us that we have no interactions. And we'll start dealing with interactions tomorrow. And so these are all of the states. So our states are basically the states with zero, one, or more than one particle. And so our total state space is what's known as a Fock space. And it's basically the direct sum of the n particle Hilbert spaces. It describes all the states in our theory. Okay, so far, yes.
You said that was a direct sum. What is that? How is that different to a regular sum?
So a direct sum, that just basically means that each of our states is in one of the Hilbert spaces. It can't be in, so for instance, we can specify the state K that lives in the one particle Hilbert space. So that's in one of the components of the Fock space. We also have states that the vacuum state, which lives in the zero particle Hilbert space. That's also part of our state space here. And what that is, equation is saying is just that our total state space is the it consists of the Hilbert spaces with any number of particles. We won't really need anything more than that. I guess the key point is there that our state space is not itself a single Hilbert space. So some of the properties you've learned of Hilbert spaces don't apply to the state space of quantum field theory, and I'll point those out when they're relevant. So far, I've been working in the Schrodinger picture. It's often useful to instead work in the Heisenberg picture, where the operators evolve in time. And the time evolution is very similar to what you've already learned from non-relativistic quantum mechanics. So if we have an operator that's in the Heisenberg picture, so I'll denote Heisenberg operators by explicitly indicating their time dependence. It's related to the Schrodinger picture operator just by vectors e to the iht times O Schrodinger e to the mi minus iht. And our two most important operators so far are the creation and annihilation operators. So let's figure out how they transform, how they evolve in time in the Heisenberg picture. So this is just e to the iht ap e to the minus iht, which is equal to e to the minus iep t ap. Since H and AP is minus EP AP. So if we use this equation together with the BCH theorem, we can simplify this expression and get this time evolution. And similarly, the creation operator evolves in time just with a plus sign here. Plus sign in the exponent, as you'd expect. Okay. And we can plug these into our expression for the field operator, 5x. To figure out how the field operator looks like in the Heisenberg picture. And if we do that, we find a very nice Lorentz invariant expression. So the time dependence of the creation and annihilation operators combines in a Lorentz invariant way with the spatial e to the I PXs we had before. This is Eisen Lorentz invariant. However, it's not the whole story. In the Schrodinger picture, our operators were time independent, so we just imposed commutation relations. In the Heisenberg picture, what we need to do is impose equal time commutation relations. So the Schrodinger picture commutation relations work at a single time, but they don't tell. We would have to use the time dependence of these operators in order to figure out how the field commutes with how phi commutes with pi at different times. And those expressions are not, in general, not simple to write down. So this equation is valid only when at equal times. And likewise, we only have that 5x commutes with 5y, or pi of x commutes with pi of y at equal times.
But then, how can you go from the result there to the Lorentz invariants?
So the point is just that we get Lorentz invariant factors here. How to get this equation? Yeah, okay, so.
It seems like we have some result. We use some result here and then say that we.
So what we did was we just plugged these into phi of x. The Schrodinger picture operator is equal to integral d3k over 2 pi cubed to ek. AK e to the plus I x dot k plus AK dagger e to the minus I x dot k. So if we plug these results into this expression, we get this. Yes?
Phi is that an operator? Does it satisfy like a Heisenberg version of motion as well?
It does, yes.
It's only equation of motion? Does it just satisfy the Klein-Gordon equation in some way? As an operator?
As an operator, yes, it will. So, basically all of the results. From ordinary Heisenberg picture and ordinary non-relativistic quantum mechanics carry over. The difference really is we have a continuous number of operators.
Also, is there any I mean, when you go to the Hamiltonian formalism, you break covariance.
Yes.
Explicit covariance, right? Is there any way to write these commutations relation as something which is covariant, like, say, arbitrary space-like separations, or, you know, instead of like same time and I don't know.
We know the time dependent. So the question was, how do can we write these commutation relations when the time is not equal? But, right. So we know how these operators evolve in time. So we can we could compute the unequal time commutation relations. They are not pretty. They're messy. So they don't look manifestly Lorentz invariant. So this is one of the main drawbacks of the canonical formalism, is although everything we're doing is, in fact, Lorentz invariant, it's often not clear at all. If you want to do everything in a Lorentz invariant way from the beginning, the simplest way is the path integral formalism, which we'll learn about in QFT2. So there we can maintain Lorentz invariance the whole way through.
Right, but even for different time, if the separation is space-like, are we going to have like zero? Or for example, for phi and pi there, for example, would you still have the same kind of delta? But if they were like the same guy at a space-like separation, would you get zero?
That's an excellent question, and I will come to that in a few minutes. Yes,
I have another question. So, actually, we have been using the canonic commutation to formulate this conical theory, and we can also use path integral to give another formulation of conical theory. So my question is, can we use a Schrodinger picture to formulate this? I mean, without using the canonic commutation relation by pi commutator equals delta, we don't use that. We just use states to build the field theory.
Yes, there are other perspectives. We could have started from the assuming something about the states, and it would be entirely equivalent to what we're doing. So I took the perspective that these commutation relations are fundamental, but you could take the perspective that the states and how they transform is fundamental. That's another way of building up quantum field theory that's entirely equivalent.
Something like the Schrodinger equation that sets them as some basic assumptions, and they can replace the rule of the computation relation. I mean,
sorry, can you repeat
a bit? We just avoid using that computation relation, and if we set equation or something like that as our basic assumption.
Oh. So can we start with the Schrodinger equation as our basic assumption?
Do Heisenberg picture like that, you're implicitly using.
Yeah, I think it should be equivalent to what we're doing. If you're doing it that way, it'd probably be simpler to start from the path integral formalism.
Path integral formalism is another formalism.
Yeah.
Actually, there are three. Commutator relation, this approach, and the path integral approach, and the Schrodinger equation approach.
Schrodinger equation approach, okay. So there was just a question that was starting to ask about causality, about the unequal time commutation relations of the fields. So, because we're using the canonical formalism, the Lorentz invariance is not manifest. And one in particular consequence of Lorentz invariance that we really want to keep is we want our theory to be causal. And one requirement for a theory to be causal is that any two Heisenberg picture operators should commute if the operators are space-like separated. So we need this because if we do two space-like separated measurements, we don't want the result of one measurement to affect the result of another measurement, which could be possible if this commutator was non-zero. So as we will show, in a few minutes, the commutator between x and y takes this form. So I will show this later, but I just want to give you the result now, discuss some of the consequences of it. So we'll compute this commutator in a few minutes and find this result. So a few comments about this. So first of all, this is Lorentz invariant. Secondly, it's a number, not an operator. Notice there's no operators on the right-hand side, no A's or phi's or anything like that. This property is only holds in the free theory. The other properties will hold even in interacting theories. Furthermore, it does obey this causality property. This commutator vanishes for space-like separation. And to see that, let's choose a frame where x naught and y naught are the same. You can always do that if they're space-like separated. And that leaves us with this becomes e to the plus I p dot x minus y minus e to the minus I p dot x minus y. This is the part in parentheses. And so if you remember from yesterday, the measure is invariant if we take p to minus p. So if we take p to minus p in the second term only, then we flip the sign in the exponent, and these terms cancel. So this gives us 0. So although its commutator is not zero in general, it does vanish outside of the light cone. And it's, yeah, so it's not, it's non-zero for time-like separations. So we'll come back and derive that in a few minutes, but let's do a slightly simpler calculation first before we derive that result. A simpler calculation that will help us in deriving that commutator in general. Let's ask a simple question. What is the amplitude for a particle to propagate from y to x? And so I'll give this propagator a name. Call it d of y minus x. And it's just y of x. 5, 1, 0. So remember, the state that contains a single particle at a definite position is just phi acting on the vacuum, and phi is a real field, so we don't need to conjugate here.
If phi wasn't real, would you have like phi dagger y phi x?
Yes. Or the other way around, phi dagger x, phi y. So phi would still create a particle at position y. Okay, so in order to compute this, we need to expand phi in terms of creation and annihilation operators. So we get one integral for each of the field operators called the integration variable k and p. And we have these exponentials, e to the minus I p dot x plus I k dot y. 0, AP, AK, dagger, 0. So there would, in principle, be four terms here, but three of them vanish just because they have a annihilation operator acting on the ket or a creation operator acting on the bron. OK, so and in order to compute this, we just use the commutation relations, and remember this is proportional to delta p minus k. And the constant and proportionality just cancels off one of these denominators. This one is missing a 2. And so if we just use the commutation relations to compute this expectation value, we basically just kill one of the integrals, and we're left with integral d3p over 2 pi cubed 2ep e to the minus I p dot x minus y. Okay. So, let's look at this for space-like separations. So we're asking, can a particle propagate from some point, space-time point y, to another space-time point x, if x and y are not causally connected? So again, let's choose a frame where x naught is y naught. And let's give a name to x minus y. Let's call that r. So what do we find? Using our previous result, we get integral g3p over the familiar 2 pi cubed 2 ep. The a exponential just becomes plus I, using the mostly minus signature, e dot r. And this integral is non-zero. It's not no reason that this integral should vanish. And in fact, you can show that it is just some overall factors times the Bessel function. This is a modified Bessel function of the first kind. Second kind. It's not a particularly illuminating result, but you can either compute or look up the asymptotic behavior of this Bessel function. And asymptotically, this as this 2-point function looks like m to the 3/2 over 4 pi squared r to the 3/2 root pi over 2 e to the minus mr. And this is as r goes to infinity. So it does go to 0 exponentially fast, but it's non-zero for any value of r. So this is perhaps surprising and maybe concerning.
M is the mass of the Klein-Gordon field?
M is the mass.
So for a massless case, that would always be zero, 2-point function, or just in the case of space-like separation?
So there would be
massless principle and linear decay.
If we set m to 0, yeah, so this is just 0. K1 is 0, 0. I'm not certain, but I think it's just always here.
Would you have to use a photon propagator instead of what you were defining the propagator?
So a massless scalar is different from a massless gauge boson.
You get a divergence.
Yeah.
Because you have a 1 over p here. You get a
p squared over p squared. So.
Yeah, but then you have something which is odd everywhere.
Right.
Yeah.
So it should vanish. Okay, so how concerned about this should we be? Turns out not very. We can never measure the amplitude for a particle to propagate outside of its lycon. So let's draw a picture here. Say this is point X. This is point Y. So the best we can do is measure that there is a particle at X and there is a particle at Y. We can't tell whether the particle propagated from X to Y or from Y to X. There's no unique way to time order X and Y if they're space-like separated. And any measurement we're going to do is going to be related to the commutator, which is just d of x minus y minus d of y minus x. And so even if each of these amplitudes individually is non-zero, their amplitudes will cancel. And in fact, the cancellation would be more interesting if we had started with a complex scalar field. Complex scalar fields can carry charge, and so we can have a distinct particle and antiparticle. And what we would find is that this cancellation would be between a particle and an antiparticle.
Sorry, I don't get why can you only measure the commutator?
Well, so there's no way you can directly measure an amplitude, right? We can only measure, we could measure that there is a particle at point X, spacetime point X, and we can measure that there is a particle at spacetime point Y. We can't even say it's the same particle. All of the excitations of this field are identical. So that's really all we can measure. It could be the same particle. It could be that the particle that was at X went to Y. But it could also be that the particle that was at Y went to X. There's no experimental way we can distinguish those possibilities. So that's what happens for space-like separations. Let's look at what happens inside the light cone. And let's move back to this commutator, delta x minus y. So also pointed out that we have demonstrated the claimed formula up there. So if we just take delta of x minus y is d of x minus y minus d of y minus x. And so we showed one of those terms. We computed d y minus x. So we've also computed delta of y minus x is what I promised it was earlier. Okay. So let's compute this inside the light cone. And each of the steps in this derivation will look much more natural going backwards than forwards. What I'm doing in each step will look somewhat weird, but I'll just write down some expression and then try to argue back that going backwards, it makes sense. So our starting expression is this minus e to the plus rp minus x. And the first thing I'm going to do is to flip some signs in the second term. And I'm going to explicitly write out where we're evaluating p0 at. So remember, in this expression, p0 is implicitly equal to ep. I'll write that explicitly for the first term. And for the second term, I'm going to change some signs. Write this as plus 1 over minus 2ep e to the minus ip dot x minus y evaluated at p naught is minus ep. And so I really haven't done anything to the first term. I've just explicitly written out our assumption that we've had the whole time. For the second term, I've changed the sign of p naught. I've accounted for that with an extra sign here. I've also flipped the sign of the spatial component, but that's something we've done many times. That's just because if we do the change of variables p goes to minus p in the integral, we don't change the measure. So that's okay here. Okay, so why have I done this? Here's something else, right? In another strange strange relation that will be easier to see going backwards. So let's write this as a four-dimensional integral. Where the p0 integral is along a complex contour that I'm going to call CR. And 1 over p squared minus m squared times this exponential. And, okay. So I'll draw the contour in a minute, but I just want to point out that this is p squared minus p vector squared minus m squared, which is equal to p naught squared minus ep squared. And let me draw the contour on a different board. Okay, so contour is going to be contour that goes around the two poles in the integrand. So there's a pole at minus ep and plus ep, and goes around in this direction. This is the real part of p naught. This is the imaginary part of p naught. And so if x naught is greater than y naught, we can close the contour in the lower half plane. And we'll enclose the two poles there. And so just by Cauchy's theorem, we'll pick up the residue at the pole. And that gives us the line before. On the other hand, if y naught is greater than x naught, we have to close the contour in the upper half plane, and we get zero. So this this works if x naught is greater than y naught. And so the reason I put an R subscript on our contour, this is CR, is this is this gives us what's known as the retarded propagator, which is theta x naught minus y naught 0 times commutator phi of x phi of y 0. So I've done a few things here. So first of all, I noted that this integral gives us 0 if y naught is greater than x naught. And because the commutator is just a number, not an operator, and our vacuum is unit normalized, we get the same thing if we compute the commutator or the expectation value of the commutator. So this is what's called the retarded propagator, and we can rewrite it in a slightly more compact form than what I wrote before. Why is it called the retarded propagator? This is a Green's function for the Klein-Gordon operator. And we can see that straightforward manner. So let's act with Klein-Gordon operator on this supposed Green's function. And Klein-Gordon operator ignores everything except for the exponential. And we just, if we act with a derivative on this exponential, what we get is just minus t squared plus m squared. Minus I P X minus Y. And this cancels. So we're left with, we do get a minus 1 and this I left over. And have this exponential. But this is an integral we've done many times. This just gives us a delta function. Four-dimensional. So it is, in fact, a Green's function. And note that we didn't use the contour anywhere in this derivation. So if we had chosen a different contour, we'd still get a Green's function in the Klein-Gordon operator. And so this is called the retarded propagator because we can use it to solve the Klein-Gordon equation with a source. If we impose boundary conditions at some fixed time and want to evolve in the future. We can also define an advanced propagator. It's not going to be, so the advanced and retarded propagators are advanced and retarded Green's functions are most useful in classical physics, but neither are particularly useful for quantum field theory. Instead, the most useful Green's function will be the so-called Feynman propagator. And so let me just define that. And that will be the last thing we'll do today. So, Feynman propagator. is find to be Heaviside function of x naught minus y naught times 5x, 5y plus the opposite Heaviside function with the opposite ordering of 5x and 5y. This is a rather lengthy expression, and we're going to be writing things like this all the time, where the ordering of the operators depends on the time ordering, the ordering of the zeroth component of the argument of those operators. So we can write this in a significantly more compact way by just introducing the time ordering symbol. This is the time ordering. Symbol. And it just means put the latest operator to the left. And so we can, using the same ideas as before, write this as a contour integral. However, it's most common to just include an I epsilon in the denominator. It's a mnemonic for the contour. I'll draw the contour anyways. And so the contour looks like this. So there are two poles at plus and minus EP. And this, so we've added a small imaginary part, which to basically shifts the poles slightly off the contour. So we'll shift this pole at minus EP slightly above the contour if we integrate it along slightly above the real axis, and this one slightly below the real axis. So this I epsilon just reminds us that we want to go below the pole at minus EP and above the pole at plus EP. And so this Green's function, so the argument to show that this gives us the same thing as this is basically the same as we did in the case of the retarded Green's function. And this is the most useful propagator for us precisely because of this time ordering symbol. So over the next four lectures, what we're going to do is develop the technology to compute cross sections and decay rates. And so that's going to be a several step process. And so tomorrow, basically what we're going to do is we're going to relate scattering amplitudes to endpoint functions of interacting fields. And then on Friday, we'll relate those endpoint functions of interacting fields to time-ordered products of free fields. That's precisely what we have here. So that's why this propagator is so important. This is the time-ordered product of free fields. And it's going to show up all the time because will allow us to basically over the next two lectures we'll see how to relate time order products of free fields to amplitudes that relate an initial state to a final state in interacting theory. that's where we're going. Any question?
Where do you close a circuit?
So it would depend on whether X naught is greater than Y naught. So if it's the same as over there, if X naught is greater than Y naught, we close below. Yep. And in the opposite case, we close. Any other questions? All right, I'll see you in tutorial.